ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Two Dimension Comics, the podcast with no direction. This is episode number 14. I am your host, Dallas Busha, and with me...
Al.
And Don.
Gentlemen, how you doing?
Good.
Good.
Awesome. This is actually really nice. This is, we haven't done this in a long time, but we're all in the same room together. It's actually really cool. Don and I are trying to stay as still as possible so we don't move around the microphones and make a ton of noise. But I don't know. I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah,
it actually feels like we're just kind of sitting around hanging out. I think it's going to be nice.
All right.
So, had a good Halloween. What about you guys?
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, it was good.
Yep. Cool.
Not too many kids came by, but hey, you know. I had fun anyway.
We were, God, you know, Ellie and I bought bags and bags of candy because we kind of overcompensated because last year we ran out of candy pretty early on in the evening. So... Publix had, like, buy one, get one, so we got a ton of candy. We filled up a huge bowl. Well, that night, Halloween night, we ended up going out and with our nephew trick-or-treating. So we didn't get home till almost 9 o'clock, and we didn't get one trick-or-treater after that. Uh-huh. So we had huge bags. Actually, that's where all those Reese's and all that stuff came from.
Yeah, thank you very much.
I
enjoyed them.
I brought them into work, dropped them all off. I was like Santa Claus for a day. I felt special.
That's funny.
So we're based out of Al's house today. And this is my first time here, and you've got a flipping huge collection, man. I love seeing this stuff.
Oh, there's plenty of comics. I haven't even gotten into the garage.
I know. You're going to have to show me that later.
Yeah.
This is like at least 10 times the size of my collection. It's great looking.
Oh, I've been collecting since, you know, back when tablets, you know, when they were...
It is always fun to go to your friend's house and dig through his stuff. I don't know why. It's fun when you have your own, but it's more fun when somebody else has it.
I know. I'm sitting here. Well, I'm looking. What am I? I got this book all about a bunch of EC artists. Ding, ding. And I'm sitting here. And ever since we got here, I've been like a kid in a candy store thumbing through all Al's stuff. And so I'm sitting here looking at this EC book, and the guys are getting ready, and Al's pretty much pressing record, and Don's like, Dallas, get your game face on.
Game on.
Exactly.
Yeah, like we need that.
So, for a topic tonight, I was kind of hoping we could finally, after 14 episodes, get around to Don Moore's favorite artists in comic books. How do you feel about that, Don?
There you go.
All right. I'm glad I didn't catch you off guard.
You know, it's like anything with favorites. Everybody's got a lot of favorites. I was thinking about this long and hard. I started thinking, well, maybe I should just write everything down. I've got 50 artists written down, and... Even so, there's a lot more I do like, but...
You wrote that a while back, too. I remember you showed me that at work, and you were so excited about talking about it on the show.
This is going to be a long show, folks.
No,
might be a three-hour show.
I narrowed it down to my top 10, a list of 10, which was actually difficult, but easier than I thought it would be. One criteria I made was there's a lot of artists I loved at one point or another, but... What I did was these 10 artists are people that no matter what, I seek out the stuff and buy the stuff. There's some artists that I loved when I was younger, but the work they were doing later in life, I just didn't enjoy as much. So anyway, I'm going to start from number 10 and work my way down. The first artist on the list is Steve Rude, which really surprises me that we've never mentioned him on any show we've done so far.
I think he was on my list.
Yep.
But that was an episode that Al and I did, and clearly Don didn't listen to it.
No, I did listen to it, but I didn't know you mentioned it.
Yeah, we just went over it really fast, but that just means that I share your love for Steve Rude.
You know, he's got a style I love. It's always, to me, a cross between Alex Toth and Russ Manning, who did Magnus the Robot Fighter, mm-hmm. and Jamie Wyatt, Andrew Wyatt. I love his line drawings. I love how he tells a story. I love all the things he puts into everything. Nexus has always been my favorite. I love the story. I love the whole series. I really don't understand why it doesn't sell. So I'm told. I thought it was one of the greatest comics in the world.
Is it still being published?
No. They
He had a big thing a few years back that he was going to come back into comics and start doing Nexus, but it didn't pan out that much. He did, what, three or four issues?
Well, it was supposed to be a four-issue series. You know, Mike Barron wrote it again, but it was called Rude Dude Productions. And they were supposed to do four issues. They ended up doing three, but the third issue was a double size, so they did all four. But
It's a good story.
Yeah, he was planning on doing that in The Moth, you know, his other strip he did with Gary Martin. But... Yeah, it didn't pan out, But what I understand was when FIRST is doing Nexus, that's when I started reading it. And I was really shocked at just how good the story and artwork was. And I was reading some review in one of Fantagraphics books, and Jan Strnad was talking about it, talking about what a good strip it was, you know, how good the writing was, how clear the artwork was, and how imaginative it was. And then his question was, why aren't these guys rich? And that's when I found out that the book just wasn't selling. And he said, the only thing I get is some people say it's just too much of a good thing. Well, they went over to Dark Horse later, and Dark Horse, you know, really put them out really, really nice. They were doing four-issue series all the time. But I guess eventually they switched it to black and white, and they just dropped it. Again, it wasn't selling, which makes me scratch my head. I like the work that Steve Root did. Like, he did Dave Gibbons wrote a World's Finest for DC. And that's the first time I ever saw anybody draw Superman as the Golden Age, you know, the Joe Shuster Superman. And he drew Batman the way he first started when he was in Detective Comics. I see people do that now, but at the time, Steve Rude was the first one I saw. He always put a lot of thought and effort in everything he did. It wasn't just, you know, knocking things out, doing one way. He thought everything out. So, anyway, that's number 10.
But the last thing I remember seeing by Rude was he did like a Spider-Man miniseries, maybe like 5 years ago, and he was drawing it in kind of like a Romita style. Did you ever see that one?
No, I wasn't aware of that one.
It was, God, I can't remember the name of it, but it was real nice, and that's the last thing I've seen. Has it been anything newer since?
Well, he's done some things. I know he did, for Marvel, he did a Thor miniseries. I think it was 3 issues.
Okay.
That was pretty good. He started to do an X-Men, Children of the Atom.
Yeah, that was a really, really good series. That's when he kind of had a falling out with Marvel, right?
Well, I just know he did, 2 issues of it?
No, it was like 3 or 4, and then the last couple were Paul Smith, I think, took over.
Yeah, I know he didn't finish it. It was really nice, and but it was the original 5 X-Men.
Oh, wow.
And then he...
It was kind of not a retelling, but it was like the story leading up to X-Men number 1, the old Stan Lee X-Men number 1.
Hey, next time if we go to a store, let me see if you can find him. I'd love to get
him. Why don't I just bring him in on Monday to work?
Oh, that's awesome.
Borrow
that's even better, yeah. I can read him at work while I don't do my job.
Exactly. They're really good, though.
It was a good story, and the artwork was good. But that was the thing that irritated me, is he didn't finish it. He did... trying to think. One of my favorite things he did was for DC in 1986. He did a Mr. Miracle special.
Yes.
And Mark Evanier wrote it. And that one, it had that whole Jack Kirby feel. Even though it was Steve Rude and Mark Evanier, the story went along with it. You know, Darkseid was scheming and doing things. And it was an oversized special edition. Some of his best work, besides the Nexus work. I also liked... he did another strip with Gary Martin called The Moth that Dark Horse put out. And really nice work. I was looking forward. He was supposed to publish it himself again, but, you know, that just didn't pan out. But I just never understand. On Facebook, he's always posting sketches and drawings and watercolors. Beautiful. Even when he does sketches for people, he always has fantastic compositions. It's not just one stock drawing like a lot of us would do. And I can't say enough about him, and it just makes me scratch my head wondering why he's just not working all the time. And you know,
he was also real influenced by the Andrew Loomis.
Yeah,
the famous artist, and you know, the Loomis books, the figure drawing for all it's worth. And
yeah, that's right. And he's got such a clean style. His line work's clean, and it's very much like that. You're right.
Yeah.
Well, his painted covers he did. I prefer line drawings. You know, sometimes some guys will paint really well and I'll like it, but I'm not always a painting fan. But when he paints, it's just breathtaking. I guess he uses watercolor.
Yeah, some of the newer stuff that he did, some of the last couple Nexuses, he had some backup stories that were all painted.
Yeah,
that
was
they looked awesome.
Wow, yeah. Nice.
So anyway.
So that was number 10. Is this in order of importance? Like number 1's your favorite? Is that what it is?
Yeah, well, I'm starting from 10, working my way down.
Yeah, okay.
So. Drum roll. Number 9.
Yeah, number 9. Alan Davis. The first time I saw Alan Davis was when he came over to the United States doing Batman and the Outsiders, which was nice. Jim Aparo, it was one of his strips, and I wasn't really thrilled that anybody else would be doing it besides Jim Aparo. And I quickly grew to love Alan Davis, and then I found out that he was one of the artists on Alan Moore's Miracle Man. And then my favorite work was the Captain Britain work he did with Alan Moore. He continued to stay on with Captain Britain, and it's just phenomenal work from the time he started drawing it all the way up to through Excalibur. He always had a continuity. He turned out to be a really strong writer as well. Yeah, right now he's always doing miniseries of, you know, whatever character he wants to do, and he's always puts a lot of thought into everything. Chris Claremont had mentioned one time he loved working with Alan Davis because there was never anything he ever wrote where Alan Davis says, "I can't draw this." It's just flawless work. It's always well thought out, and it just moves.
He's another one too with a real slick, clean line work style. He's not a minimalist, but he doesn't draw any unnecessary lines, I think.
No, he doesn't. He was, strange as it sounds, he was a huge Neil Adams fan. And
you can kind of see that because of his dynamic style. Yeah.
A lot of times when I see it, it's how he draws faces. You know, Neil Adams, I always noticed how he drew faces. He always has a even though they're drawings, it had a photo quality to it. And that's how he puts it together. Alan Davis actually considers himself more of a storyteller than an artist, even though I love his artistic style. But he's always looking at telling a story. What was it? Tomorrow's Publishing had a thing called Modern Masters, you know, series of different artists. And Alan Davis was the first one they spotlighted. And he has a really nice interview, and he's talking about storytelling. And one of the things he mentioned was Barry Smith's Red Nails. They were up, trapped up on a mountaintop, and he had to, there was a dragon. They couldn't get down, and he realized they had these poison apples up there. And it's just how they told that story really quick. You know, but he's sitting there looking, and she says, "Well, at least we won't starve," the girl with him. And then he pointed out, "Well, if you do," you know, she pointed out the apples, and says, "If you eat them, you're going to look like him." And there was a skeleton underneath, the person that tried to eat these apples. And then it showed Conan get this plan, and he's leaning over the tree from the mountaintop, cutting them. And he said that's what Barry Smith always, you know, threw him, was how he told the story. He explained to you how remote they were up on the mountaintop. He said anybody else just would have had trees right there, and he'd just reach up above and cut them instead of leaning over, just like, you know, in real life. So he always thinks things out. And I say this a lot for people I like, but he always has a lightheartedness to a lot of the stuff he does. So, Alan Davis is number 9, and again, I still, to this day, seek out anything he does. He just seems to get better and better.
Yeah, he is good. He did, the last thing that I saw him do was, probably a year, maybe 2 years back, he did, some Astonishing X-Men work with Warren Ellis, and it was pretty good. He's still doing some really good stuff, and I mean, he's a good designer, too. That's why I can see why Neil Adams was an influence on him.
Oh, yeah. I never knew that.
Yeah, it's called Ghost Boxes. It was a miniseries, and he did a short story in there with Warren Ellis. It was good.
And there was that other artist, Brian Hitch, who kind of couldn't tell him apart for a while. He just seemed like he was...
Yeah.
He looked exactly almost like Alan.
Did Brian Hitch, didn't he do like Planetary and all that stuff?
He did Excalibur too after he left. But he's changed his style since. He's a little different now. But for a while there, it was like, is that Alan Davis? No, it's Brian Hitch. And wow, okay, all right, cool.
It's funny you mentioned that. I remember I never could really tell when I was a kid one artist from another, you know, up to a point. And a friend of mine I went to college with was talking about when John Byrne took over from Dave Cockrum on X-Men.
Oh, you're talking my language now.
Yeah.
Dave Cockrum, right.
You know, that was to me a major change. I like both artists, you know, but I could tell right away. It was, you know, kind of jarring. And my friend said he didn't realize that it changed. He thought it was the same artist. And he says eventually when he did realize it was a new artist, he thought John Byrne was just trying to be a Dave Cockrum clone. It's funny to say now, but I remember at a time where I would have thought the same thing.
Kirby was the one for me. He always looked different from everybody else.
Yeah.
You know, you look at Kurt Swan's Superman, which is beautiful, and you look at Kirby, and it's like two different, completely different guys. Never would you confuse the two.
What did you say earlier about Jack Kirby, Dallas?
Besides that I said he was the man.
Yes,
yeah, so
about
remember.
A thousand imitators and only one.
Oh, yeah, cool, because you said, you know, there was really, there's only one Jack Kirby. You can, you know, you were saying the same thing as Al did, and I'm like, yeah, but there were 10,000 imitators.
Yeah.
You know, at the time Marvel was becoming so popular, you know, everybody was trying to do Kirby, but yeah, no one could.
Well, they were asked to. They were saying, I think Stan Lee would tell them, I want you to draw it in the Kirby style, and then people like Rich Buckler thought, oh, yeah, it means draw like Jack Kirby. I was like, no, no, just dynamic.
Well, you know, one thing, you mentioned that about Rich Buckler before. I loved it when he tried to draw like Jack Kirby.
That was a lot of fun.
It was fun, and I mean, he really pulled it off. It was, you know.
Who's Rich Buckler? What did he do?
He was a Marvel artist from the 70s. He did a lot of, he did FFs, he did, what else did he do? A lot of fill-in issues, mostly. Yeah. Oh, Deathlock.
He was a co-creator, Deathlock.
He was, and that's a cool book, Deathlock.
He was in.
Yeah, I remember, that sounds familiar. I've heard of it.
He's half android, half man. He's cool.
He was in 74. He was the Fantastic Four artist, but I mean, he did everything. He did all the Fantastic Four monthly issues. He did Giant Size Fantastic Four. He did the first Giant Size Avengers. He was, I don't know how many books he was drawing a month, but he was
doing a lot.
Prolific.
He was one of the new guys that came in the 70s. Before the 70s, it was pretty much of a closed shop. I think Neil Adams was one of the few that actually broke in. But after 70, like when Wrightson and Kaluta and Jones, all of them got in, Rich Buckler came in a little bit after them. But he's good. I'll show you some work.
Yeah, his early Marvel work, well, you know, you got to remember, I was 12 years old, but I loved it. I still look at it, and it always makes me happy. There was a dynamic to it, but he was straight out just, you know, drawing Jack Kirby. He was making it look like Jack Kirby, but, I mean.
He came in around the same time as George Perez.
No, all right.
Well, I think George Perez was an assistant for him for a while.
Probably.
Because Rich Buckler, like I said, I loved his Fantastic Four work. But then later on he came in on, when George Perez started doing it, I'm like, wow, this is something. It was tighter, you know. And then eventually George Perez took over the book. But Rich Buckler would pop up again in the 80s when Red Circle was doing all those Archie books.
Those are cool, man.
Yeah, he came back and was doing some more.
He did The Fly, I think, right? Or
The Fly. I just knew he was drawing some. I said, his style was different. It wasn't the Rich Buckler that I love so much.
Right.
You're talking to Archie. I just happened to look over, and there's like a stack of Archie books over there. Jeez, Al, you got everything in here.
I try. I got a Rich Buckler book in there somewhere.
Of course you do.
I'll show it to you during the break.
Maybe just move in for a month and...
Yeah, just leave them all. Now, what's number, what are you up to, 7 now?
Okay, now it's 7. And we've talked about this person before. It's Alex Toth.
Oh, man,
Of course, he's on everybody's top 10 list, isn't he?
Alex Toth is one, usually, most of us, I think, whenever you have a favorite artist, is always because of a certain series that you like. Like, you know, I mentioned Steve Root and Nexus. You know, it was something you could follow. Alex Toth is the one exception where he would never on anything. He just always randomly pick up a 4-page story or 6-page story. And you go, oh my God, who is this? I remember I was 9 years old. My neighbor used to get Cartoons Magazine, which was a magazine size, black and white. It was about muscle cars. He was a mechanic, you know, and when before he'd toss them, he'd just give them to me. I'd kind of thumb through him, but once in a while I'd see a drawing. What is this? And it was Alex Toth. I never knew his name. I'd see stuff in War Comics for DC, the horror comics DC put out. Once in a while, even one of the superhero books. But just something else. I could always, you know, eventually start recognizing it. He was always fluid. He was always just outstanding the way he told the story. I was in college, like I said, when I found out he did all that work for Hanna-Barbera. He was the guy that designed Space Ghost. And
that's how I knew of him when I was a little kid.
Well, he just always did strong, simple designs. And he just knew. And I never get tired of looking at his work. always buy any kind of collection they have. And it just seemed like no matter how many collections I see, somebody else has one, I have to stop and look at it. And as we say all the time on the show, he was absolutely one of them. As soon as you saw his work, you wanted to get a pen and paper and start drawing. He just always brought that out of you. So he's number 7. That was number 8, pardon.
Wait, who have we had so far? Steve Rude?
Steve Rude, Alan Davis, Alex Tobin.
Oh, okay, all right.
Okay, the next one I'm going to cheat. I'm going to do 2. Los Bros Hernandez, Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, first time I ever saw these guys, I was in college in Fantagraphics in the Comics Journal. They were always putting out the cover of the first Love and Rockets. And at the time, I'd never seen anything like it. And it was really strange that these two guys just appeared and nobody knew who they were. And I said, this is really strong work. One of my friends said that they saw a color copy of it, and it was amazing just how they put the covers on the illustration. When the first Love and Rockets came out, nobody could get it. I guess it was big in California, but in Oklahoma, it never appeared at any of the stores. When I joined the Navy, I guess they had done 3 issues, and I found them all out there. Just staggering work. The drawings were something, the stories were different, and both of these guys can draw, and draw well. And even though they're distinctly different, they just mesh together. But to this day, Love and Rockets is still my favorite. I can't wait to get it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Those guys are amazing. They're probably some of my favorites too. I don't think they were on my list. I don't remember, but they definitely deserve to be.
Well, it's hard. Like I said, there's so many artists, and you know, you can only put so many on it. You know, before we just, you know. The one thing about these, I love their drawings. I love how they draw, but it's also how they tell a story and how they put things together. One that always stayed with me was Jaime when he did the death of Speedy Ortiz. And it was just one half page. You know, the whole story builds up and builds up. And finally at the very end, he doesn't show the guy die. It just shows the cop at night come out to the car and says, come on, buddy, you can't sleep here. And then he stands there for a minute. You're just seeing the cop through the roll-down window. And he calls his partner and says, hey, get on the radio. And then it switches. It shows one panel, and it shows the guy's friend in the hospital, you know, in intensive care. And it shows him his hand come out, and he shakes his friend's hand. And then the next panel, it shows his girlfriend woken up in bed, and he's holding her hand, and she's looking like kind of gasping. And the last panel, it shows his sister, Izzy, and, you know, she's asleep in the dark, and he's just saying, hey, I just want to say, you know, sorry. And she gets up panicking and says, well, what's going on? Hold on just a minute. No, you don't need to turn the light on. I just want to tell you I'm sorry for all the trouble I put you through, and things will be better now. And as she was panicking, and said, hold on, let me turn on the light. And as she did, there was nothing there. And then she found out Speedy was dead. You know, like I said, that was, what, 4 panels? When I read that, I'll never forget, I was actually in a Wendy's. I just bought the book. I was getting ready to go to a second job I had. And I'm reading that, and I thought, God, how does this guy do this? You know, 4 panels, and it really touches you. The last piece he did was in a Love and Rockets news stories, and it was called a story called Brown Town. And, yeah, funny name, but I'm not going to go into that one, but it's how he turned that story around. It was a good story. You know, it's about Maggie and her family when they first moved to Dairytown. And then finally at the very end, I said, wow, how did he do this? It just, the whole thing just fit together. Gilbert with his heartbreak soup and how he tells the stories and how he puts it together. Like I said, I love them for their artwork, but the stories really get personal and touch you, but sometimes it's how they put them together is just something else. It's just as strong.
Yeah, for those guys, I think it's a mix of everything. It is the storytelling and the art, because they are storytellers because they're writing and drawing their own stories. And one thing I love about both of them is they have a huge cast of characters. It's an ensemble cast. but each character is so distinct and so distinctly drawn, even though they're all in the same style, you can always tell who's who. You know, you'll never confuse that. And that's another one I noticed. You really like the clean line work artist. I mean, they really have an economy of line that, once again, just like, you know, just like Steve Rude and... Toe too, actually, I guess, right? You know, not a line goes to waste, especially with the Brothers Hernandez. I mean, it's very clean. It's very bold, thick ink.
Yeah, it's what I prefer. Now, like I said, we were talking about the studio guys, you know, Barry Smith, Michael Kaluta. I'm not a detail guy, but there are some I absolutely love that do get detailed. But yeah, I do prefer what they call the clear line style. That's always my favorite. The Los Bros Hernandez, though, I even like other work they did, like the first four issues of Mr. X.
Oh, yeah, man. I remember when I first met you, you were raving about that story. You wouldn't stop until I read it.
No, that's me.
Well, they only did the first issue, right?
First four.
Oh, I thought, okay, all right.
Yeah, the first four. And then they got mad because they hadn't gotten paid, and they left, and then somebody else came in.
I'd get mad, too.
Well, yeah. Well, they eventually did get paid. That's one thing about them that I always liked is how they can tell stories. In the first issue of Love and Rockets, you know, Jaime had those stories. The first one was called Mechanics. It was about Maggie and Hopi. And basically she wakes up in her apartment. It's just this, you know, young Hispanic girl. And next thing you know, she's on this hovering space cycle going to work.
I remember that.
Yeah, she's a mechanic working on robots and spaceships and stuff. And which is fun, you know. And then the second story is her and Hopi walking around Los Angeles, or some town or barrio outside Los Angeles. And, you know, it's just a couple of girls trying to go see a punk band. And it's a completely different world. And I thought, how does he pull this off? And you believe it. You know, he had wrestlers, all kinds of stuff in there. But
they were huge wrestling fans, right? Yeah. Like, they were always bringing wrestlers into their stories.
Luchadores.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right.
Gilbert would do the same thing. He'd have the most bizarre stories in the thing where, you know, it was always giant monsters and outer space creatures. And then he'd turn around and do Heartbreak Soup about a town of Palomar somewhere in South America.
And like Luba.
Yeah, Luba, all that stuff. But yeah, it's, the funny thing, the big, what was it, they were in Palomar, but the big city they used to go see the movies and stuff was called San Fidel. What's Fidel, Al?
Noodles, isn't it?
Noodles.
Let's go to the noodles.
Yeah. Well, somebody on the ship said, San Fidel, you know what that means? They're saying sink noodle.
So,
Los Bros Hernandez, they're still, to me, they have a broad appeal, and I never get tired of their work. So, moving down the list.
Number 666666666.
This one a lot of people probably won't even know. He's a French artist named J.C. Mazières. He did a comic, or does a comic, called Valerian, Space Temporal Agent. The first time I ever saw him, it was in 1982. Dargold, the people that put out all the Asterix crap, you know, French comics that you could get, they were expanding, and they were starting to put out a lot of other French artists. And Valerian was the first one I saw, and I wouldn't pick it up. I thought the guy was a Wally Wood clone. They ended up doing four volumes in English, and then Dargold America went bankrupt, and that was the end of it. But those four books were just breathtaking. The old Katina scene that they had in Star Wars with all the aliens, that was in Valerian. They say they took the Millennium Falcon from Valerian's ship. It's different.
Well, yeah, George Lucas was really inspired by a lot of the French books, right? Even Moebius.
Well, he was a big fan of all them, and he was a big fan of Valerian. One thing in Valerian that they had was, just like in Star Wars, was all that blue light. You know, whenever you saw the ships and stuff in Star Wars, it had that blue light shining on it. And that's how these books were. But they put one out every year, and I couldn't wait for the next one. And that was, I guess, 85 was the end of it. You know, that's when I didn't get any more. The movie The Fifth Element, it was Moebius and J.C. Mazières were the production designers. And if you get the extended version on DVD, they have the whole story. They have the two men talking, and basically Luc Besson, the director.
Is it subtitled, Don? Is it subtitled?
No, it's all in English. Morbius was in a subtitle, but J.C. Mazieres actually speaks perfect English.
Oh.
But, I never get tired of seeing his work. He always has them. Walt Simonson was heavily inspired by him. But his designs, I can't, it just amazes me when somebody puts a comic strip together and they can think it out just so completely. He builds worlds, he has his own style. Whenever he draws simple people, like peasants, in primitive places, it's just what the clothes they're wearing, everything's thought out, even if it's just a loincloth. He always has designs and all kinds of elements on it. He draws the most fantastic creatures and aliens, spaceships, just cities, everything. And each one can be vastly different. They ended up, Byron Preece published three of his books in a smaller size, one volume. I loved it. These things are large. They're larger size French albums. So, and that's my complaint was, I'm happy it came out, but I wish it was a little larger. And I wish everything else was put out in English, but nevertheless. But yeah, J.C. Mazieres, there's not a lot of stuff you can get in English, but what you can, find it and read it. It's just beautiful.
Nice. Well, before we break into the top five, why don't we take a music break?
There you go.
And this particular artist is the one that we were going to play last episode, but we had some technical difficulties, as we do every show. This is Don's brother. Once again, do you want to give us a little introduction to this song?
Yeah, this is my brother. His name's Larry Moore. He put this out when he was in college. It's a three-piece. He wrote it, sang it, and he played bass. I had heard it way back in, I think, 85 when he did it. And I never heard it again. I asked for some, material on the show, and he had to pull this off an old dad tape. I just went home recently, and my sister-in-law was laughing. I says, "Have you played that on your show?" I says, "No, not yet." And she kept laughing about it, that everybody in Oklahoma was wanting a copy of it. Friends of his found out about it, and it started, it turned into a virus. My brother plays in the Philharmonic, and I guess one of the guys in the Phil was talking about, adapting it for the Phil. And so my brother was always kind of laughing but kind of embarrassed about it. He's also a teacher. And one of the teachers is an older lady came up to him and says, "Everybody's got this song. Can you give me a copy?" And his comment was, "Well, I'd be glad to," says, "but I think you need to understand that I wrote this when I was, 19. And it's about a teenage girl shaking her butt." And the lady giggles, "Oh, just give it to me anyway." So anyway, the name of the song is Larry Moore, and it's Shake That Thing.
People in this world, one is a boy, the other's a girl, yeah. Oh yeah,
Hey, and that was Don's brother. Hope you liked it. We're back, and we're back on the topic of Don's top five favorite artists now. So going down the line, number five.
Walt Simonson, I just can't get enough. Like most of the people that ever read his books, his Mighty Thor run was the one that just stays with me. I used to see Walt Simonson. To me, he was one of the new guys that started appearing in the mid-70s. I always remembered the signature, and he always had a sketchy kind of style. I mean, it was a solid line, but he always had all kinds of lines in action, fantastic flowing forms, and he always played with everything. It just seemed like fun.
Fantastic flowing forms.
Well, yeah, listen to me. But
you're like Stan Lee right there.
Face front.
But one of the favorite things, earliest things, was when he did The Metal Men with Marty Pascoe. As Al and I have talked in the past, I loved The Metal Men when Ross Andrew drew it. And Walt Simonson still had that feel. But there was something about his work, even though it was solid and structured, it just seemed to have a liquid form to it. He would appear every once in a while to catch something else, his Manhunter series he did for DC. And when he did that X-Men Teen Titans crossover, that's the one where I really started taking notice of him. I mean, this guy is really something. He can just draw from one way or the other. Then they announced that he was going to do the Mighty Thor. And I thought, well, that's nice. I love Thor. Before that happened, he put out the Star Slammers, his own creation. It was a Marvel graphic novel. And it was just a great story. The artwork was phenomenal. I love how he plays with the letter forms, how he arranges everything, and just the drawing. In many cases, I honestly prefer seeing an artist's pencils before it's inked. A lot of times when they ink it, even though I like the solid, bold lines, a lot of times when they ink it, everything kind of turns sterile. It's not as dynamic as the original penciled pages. Walt Simonson is the one exception I can think of. His work, whether it's penciled or ink, is just bursting off the page. It's lively, and it always has kinetic energy to it. Again, when he did Thor, he wrote it and drew it, and it was just fantastic. It's one of my favorite stories, and it never stopped. He was building up and building up to this whole saga, that was basically about the Odin sword. And then when it finished, it just kept going, and it never stopped. I still pick up things. I see him write and draw. He is one of my favorite artists, but I prefer it when he does everything, when he writes it and draws it himself. Just seamless work. I honestly think everybody on the whole planet, if they haven't read the Thor stuff, they should. Anyway.
I'd say in contrast to a lot of the other artists that you've brought up on your list, I've always kind of thought that that Simonson has kind of a sketchy style. And when I say sketchy, it's not clean, straight lines like, for instance, Steve Rude or the Brothers Hernandez.
Right.
It's definitely more of a... I think it's a style of its time, at least for me it is, being from, I'm a bit younger than you. And seeing that when I was a kid, I saw some other artists at the time that were similar to Simonson. In retrospect, they were probably trying to draw in his style because he was such a pretty prolific artist. But I've always considered him a kind of an 80s artist, I guess. Because he reminds me of maybe Romita Jr. and a few guys like that. Not that their style is probably that similar, but I grew up seeing that stuff. And
yeah.
So it's all kind of a mishmash to me. I'm not really that familiar with a lot of Simonson's stuff.
Yeah, Romita Jr., he always has a lot of lines in the stuff he does. It's
yep.
a different way he does it, but I see where you're coming from. He always uses a lot of lines in it.
Well, Simonson was around in the 70s. He was around early, 74. He was another guy that came around the same time as Buckler and some of those guys. Maybe a
Perez.
Little later. But yeah, and his Manhunter was kind of different, too. It was a little sketchier, a little rougher, but the design quality, which was like the strong suit, was always the same, always
okay.
very good.
Yeah, he always had a strong design. I agree with what you're saying, Dallas. That's what I mean. Even when he inks his work, he has a dynamicism, but he does have a sketchiness to it, but I guess it's an orderly sketch.
Even so, to an extent, it's for some reason it reminds me of some Bill Sienkiewicz's stuff, because yeah. it's got that kind of scratchy style in a good way, and it's a lot cleaner than Sienkiewicz. But like I said, growing up, I saw all these artists together on the same books, and I was a kid, and it was hard for me to differentiate the art. Just like you were saying earlier, you know, when you were younger, you didn't know one artist from the other.
Right. But so. he was doing that before Sienkiewicz was doing
it. Oh, I'm sure he was. Like Al said, he's from the 70s. So, I mean, it's just he's got that stigma around him me, just because that's all I've known about him.
Right.
Was my experiences as a kid.
Yeah, he was doing that before Bill Sienkiewicz became Bill Sienkiewicz.
And Sienkiewicz was kind of started off as a Neil Adams clone.
That's right, doing the Moon Knight and all that.
Doing the Moon Knight, and then he kind of zoned. He got his own style, but he always has that Neil Adams.
Yeah, the crazy
Neil
horse.
Neil Adams look to it, you know, for me anyway.
He does, but you know, it's a funny thing. I didn't know who Bill Sienkiewicz was. My buddy Britt, we were going to Dallas to see a show, and he kept telling me that Bill Sienkiewicz is going to be there. And every time he found out I didn't know who he was, he said, he draws like Neil Adams, but he has a sketchier finish. And he did. It looked like Neil Adams. And a lot of people would bag on it. One time I heard another professional make a comment. This is Neil Adams learned by drawing people. This is Bill Sienkiewicz learned by drawing from Neil Adams. You know, everybody laughed. But you know, I will say this. Almost everybody in the industry was trying to draw like Neil Adams. I mean, think of any artist you can think of after that time. They were trying to draw like Neil Adams. Bill Sienkiewicz was the only one that could do it. I mean, you know, and then after he left Moon Knight, he just stretched everything and became who he was. He left that far behind.
Well, you know, if the entire podcast community goes down the toilet one day, the one thing that I can say that I learned from listening to podcasts over the past few years, the one redeeming value is that I learned how to pronounce Bill Sienkiewicz's name.
Yeah, but can you spell it?
Are we saying it right?
No, that's right. I didn't know how the hell to say that thing when I was growing up. I was like saying Kewitz or something. And I remember it was on a couple other comic book podcasts. They talk about the guy, and everybody was always saying Sienkiewicz. And at first, I had no idea who the hell they were talking about. And then I pieced together. I'm like, oh, that's that guy. That's how you say his name. So thank you, comic book podcasts.
Well, that's one of the few times I've ever got his name right. I'm the worst at pronouncing people's names. And
yeah, he calls me Dayless all the time.
Yeah. Well, we went to another show, and my friend Brett kept talking about Dick Giordano's going to be there. And I had no idea who he was talking about. Finally, Brett's like, you know who he was? He's the guy that inked those Green Arrow stories that you liked that Neil Adams drew. Oh, that's not. That was Dick Granata. You got to remember I was 9 years old when I was reading the name. But yeah. That's not. I do that all the time. And, you know, I never get things right. So
how about Bruce Jones?
You
know how to pronounce it.
We got Mobius right, or Moebius.
Yeah. Well, I learned that from Dallas.
No, yeah. That was another.
I always called him Mobius, and in Dallas, I always liked how he said it, and I eventually learned.
It's because I heard a French guy say it one time. He was talking on another podcast. He was like, blah, 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 Moebius.
It was on Around Comics.
Yeah, it was Around Comics, and they had that. I don't remember
the
guy's name.
It's Christian Ab.
Christian. Oh, man. Sorry, folks. Not that anyone would know.
He's an artist, and he inks. He's actually quite good.
Christian Alame.
Yeah, he's extremely interesting and entertaining when you hear him on.
Yes, he's great. And he's also extremely French, so he would know how to pronounce Moebius' name. Of course, I'm American, so I have absolutely no right to pronounce it like the French would. So I'll just keep on calling him Moebius.
Even though your last name is French, correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, my heritage is French, but personally I'm American. I'm from Wisconsin.
There you go. There was a woman we worked with. She was a French-Canadian, really outstanding lady. And when she found out I liked French comics, we talked about it. And every time I talk about J.C. Mazieres and that strip he did, Valerian, she said, oh, you mean, and she'd say it, same thing, but it just sounded so beautiful when she said it, instead of the way I just butcher everything. But anyway, yeah, Walt Simonson's number 5. I've never heard anything bad about the guy either. He just, sometime one friend of mine made a comment that Walt Simonson cast a long shadow. He's, I can't say enough about you. You're just fantastic, and I never get tired of it, and I hope you keep doing it all the time.
Yeah, I'm always hearing good stories about him and his wife, taking young artists in and helping them out, and even letting young new artists stay at their house. You know, I mean, they're good people.
He's something else. But nevertheless, even if you're the biggest jerk in the world, I still love your work, but I'm glad you're not. So moving on down the list, my next one is...
Number four.
Sergio Aragonés. I used to see his work in Mad Magazine. I was really young. It was the Marginals. They just cracked me up. I was always kind of amazed they'd actually do something like that. And then over the years, what surprised me is he never stopped. He just kept coming up with one thing after another. And he would always do work for DC. Sometimes in their war books, he'd have a page, and it'd just be, you know, panel cartoons and stuff. And I kept thinking, man, this guy's really fun. How does he keep doing all this? Then he put Plop together for DC, which is, you know, a humor magazine. And he just kept going. The story, the little jokes he put together, sometimes in Plop, he'd have, you know, 4 to 6 page stories. Always clever. He had one about an investigator, a private eye. And somebody was basically robbing art galleries. And what he was doing is some mad scientist had a little helmet, and he could step in one painting. He'd saw the paintings in half, step in one painting, step out of the other painting at the gallery, and steal everything. And,
that's cool.
You know, I won't tell the whole story, but it was always a surprise finish at the end, kind of like a Twilight Zone. The one that always put him on the list for me is when I was in college and Pacific Comics was out in the early 80s. He was doing Gru the Wanderer. Eclipse put out a Destroyer Duck, which Jack Kirby drew and Steve Gerber wrote. It was basically for the lawsuit over Howard the Duck. Everybody, you know, donated, you know, stories for the book. And Sergio Aragonés had like a, I think it was a 4-page story of Gru. It was, you know, really neat. It was a lot of fun. And again, it had the surprise ending. And I just thought, wow, this is something. And Pacific Comics put it out as a, you know, a book. I figured he'd do a few issues and then go on, like a lot of these guys. And it quickly became my favorite book. It switched from Pacific Comics to Eclipse Comics, and then later Epic Comics. And, you know, Mark Evanier wrote the stories. I guess they co-wrote them. But, I kept thinking, well, these are really neat. And each time you put one out, it was the same format, but the stories always changed. And that's what got me, was how much this guy could draw. Every time he went to another town, the town looked different. The people wore different kinds of clothes. The architecture was different. And, you know, he was just drawing from one place to another. He did, even though it was a simple, cartoony, sketchy style, there was a lot of thought behind everything he did. And, you know, always putting my own limitations on it. I just kept thinking, well, eventually he's going to run out of ideas. But he did like 120 issues with, you know, Epic. And it kept going. Eventually Dark Horse picked him up. And every once in a while they put the series out, but he's never stopped. He's always done different humor books for Dark Horse or other people, and I never get tired of seeing his work. I love you. I love stuff that you, you know, like Batlash, that, you know, you helped
Dear
put
Sergio.
Together, even though you didn't even draw it. You're an idea man first and foremost, but your drawings I never get tired of, and I don't see how you do it. There's nobody like you.
Well, now, you know, you're going completely away from the clean line style here. You're throwing me for a loop, because Sergio has such a squirrely style in a really good way. I love his art, too. And I've always loved the guy because of the amount of stuff that he just puts in his panels and his art. I mean, he's really dense. You could have he'll draw 50, 60, 70 people in a page, you know? I mean, I feel like I'm looking at a Where's Waldo book sometimes. I mean, he's just that good. Each person is doing their own unique thing, too. And he's always been good at that. And, yeah, my favorite stuff of his was Gru the Wanderer. That's I was introduced to him through the Mad Magazine stuff also, like you, but I didn't know who he was until years after the fact, because I was really young reading those Mad. But, yeah, he's great, just completely different from those other artists you've been naming.
Did he start out in Mad?
Yeah. It's a funny story to him. He's from Spain. His father was a film director. And it was when Franco was, you know, knocking everybody out, getting rid of all the intellectuals and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So they left Spain, and they were in a French concentration camp.
It's a little history for you kids.
Yeah.
A French concentration camp?
Yeah, well, you know, I guess an internment camp, I guess you used to say. You know, basically as exiles in Spain.
Oh.
And he was there. So he basically grew up in France as a kid, and he spoke French. Well, finally Mexico said they would take all the people that Franco didn't want, so they ended up going to Mexico. And I just thought that was funny when he was telling his story. It was in Comics Journal. But he said, so here in Mexico, you have a Spanish kid that speaks French. I guess he didn't speak Spanish at the time. But he grew up in Mexico, and in the 50s, he went to New York, you know, trying to sell cartoons. I guess in the very beginning, he had more of a Virgil Parch, you know, style. Virgil Parch, he did a lot of magazine illustrations, and he had a Sunday comic strip when I was a kid called Big George. I didn't particularly care for it, but I did like his work. But he was trying to sell work, and then eventually somebody said, why don't you go over to Mad Magazine? They might take what you're doing. And he went over there and has been with them ever since. I know when he had the idea for the Marginals, they said, well, this is okay. He says, but, you know, I mean, you're going to run out of information. But he was insistent. They said, well, we'll run them until you run out. Just again, like I thought. And he never stopped. I mean, he must have done those for 50 years. He's still doing them.
Is he really?
Yeah, I mean, crap. I think Mad Magazine went quarterly. It's only four times a year. Just recently, the last few years. But he did that month after month. I heard him in an interview talking. Think about any Mad Magazine you had as a kid. How many Marginals?
Yeah, that's true, man. He was a machine.
And they were funny. Again, the first one I noticed, I was 8 years old, seven or eight. And my friend was reading one of the more Drucker stories, you know, reading it to me.
There's another great artist.
Oh, man.
One of Dave Sims' favorites.
He is fantastic. But anyway, in the Marginal, I saw this cartoon. There was a guy in a rowboat throwing an anchor over the side. And underneath it is a floating mine from World War II. The anchor's getting ready to hit it. I just thought that was the most hilarious thing I ever saw. And, you know, I mean, it was an eighth of an inch big.
That's the great thing about Sergio. He was constantly creative.
But, yeah, with Matt, he always had a sketchy style, and, you know, kind of unfinished. But he went to Gru, even though he had a lot of information, and it still had a simple theme to it. And I loved when he started using the brush, you know, in Gru. He used pen work, but there was brush work, and it was phenomenal. But yeah, you're right. I mean, those two-page spreads he did in Gru, each issue, it was just something. There was one issue, one of my favorites is with a pyramid. And the two-page spread, it was these people building pyramids, and, you know, there was just figures all over the place. You could see little tiny carts, you know, equipment, you know, materials. Just, I don't know how he did it. He did it every month, and he never stopped.
I think my favorite issue of Gru was one with Gru and his dog, Roberto.
Oh, yeah.
remember that dog?
That,
it was awesome.
Yeah.
And they were in the middle of a battle between two armies on ship, and they were all in the water. And Gru had this uncanny bad luck that whenever he was on a ship, it would sink just because he was on it. But as long as his dog was with him, the ship wouldn't sink. So he's hopping from ship to ship. All these people on the ships are freaking out because they see Gru on there and they know of his history and how he always sinks ships. So they're all like, Gru's on our ship, you know, get him out of here, put him on another ship, put him on the enemy ship, he'll sink them. And it was just a hot mess, and it was such a fun, entertaining episode, and it was so clever the way he put it all together, and it just never ended. The whole story was just him hopping from ship to ship, but it never got old.
It was in the very beginning. I think the ship issue was about the fourth or fifth issue of Gru. And a lot of people at the time thought that was a high watermark. And basically, he went on a ship and sank it. And I think that first story, he sank eight different ships. That's when he found
it's got to be a record of some sort.
It was Captain Ahax was the first one. They Shanghai Gru, which is a mistake. And I just thought that's hilarious. And then, you know, the ship would come up once in a while. Captain Ahax, basically, as the series went on, he was a great captain, But he grew to hate the sea and hate ships because of what happened. His crew was falling just disgusted, and they were always taking land jobs for a while. But the series never stopped. There was at one point where Gru ended up on the ship, and it was a city. It was like 50 different wooden ships that all kind of collided, and they built a city on it. And the people were upset because somebody died, and they were mourning. When he got on the ship, he said, "Well, what's wrong?" I said, "Did you lose your king?" I said, "No, the king's right there." And you see the king mourning too. And I said, "Well, if the king's alive, who's the most important person you lost?" "The captain. The captain of that city of ships." Well, eventually Captain Ahax comes on, you know, and these people make Gru the captain. He has no idea what he's doing, but it's one of those happy accidents that everything he's doing turns out it's what they needed to happen. He starts issuing all these orders, and he was going to crash the ship. I guess they were always going to the right, sailing a circle to the right. And whatever he did, it broke part of it apart, which seemed like a disaster. And they said, "No, wait, this is, we needed to do that because they broke this apart. We need to get down there and fix it, but we never could." He did something else, and they started sailing the other direction. So that's good, because they had mold on that side, because the sun never touched them, so this will burn the mold off. Anyway, Captain Ahax came on, and he starts seeing, and he starts issuing orders, and he says, this actually is bringing back my love of ships when I was a little boy. He just thought it was phenomenal. And then he had a heart attack when he found out Gru was the captain. And the story just kept going on. But yeah, when Roberto the dog showed up, and they just, as long as Roberto was on the ship, it didn't sink. I thought, well, that's something. It never stopped. Even though they had conventions and end jokes they kept doing over and over, the story kept building and developing. You know, as the series went on, you found out Gru was ignorant. He couldn't read. And he ended up learning how to read. And they kept developing, even though it was a simple thing. I mean, basically, they had the same five jokes they always joked about in it. And, you know, it was amazing at just how stupid he was. But like I said, it always kept my interest. I was always amazed that, you know, I mean, how many times have you ever followed a series, you know, that long? You may love it, but, you know, usually it's 20, 30 issues at most, and then, you know, with a few exceptions, Cerebus. Of course, I was most people that read maybe 10, 15 issues and stopped. But
darn. But don't start bad-mouthing. I'll start talking about Dave Cockrum again.
I'm just saying, I guess Cerebus outgrew my intellect. But Gru was one that I never lost interest in, and whenever he does something Gru-related, I always go pick it up, along with anything else he puts together. So, anyway, it's number four, Sergio Arganez. I could go on and on about you, but I'll move on. Number three was actually the first artist I ever recognized. I could tell his style. I was 9 years old, and it was Carl Barks.
Nice.
I can't even recognize this. It's not bad.
Well, you know, I was 9 years old. A couple moved in next door to us. The guy was a mechanic. He just got out of the Army.
What?
I just saw an Uncle Scrooge book around here,
yeah,
too, didn't I?
Yeah,
why am I not surprised? Don, just randomly name an artist off, and the book will probably be sitting around.
Well, there is one, yeah.
But I'm sorry. Go on.
That's okay. But anyway, this guy had stacks of comics, and he passed them off to me, which is when I started saving them. But, you know, I was interested in the Superman, Batman, that kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden, he had some Disney comics in it. And I wasn't interested in reading the Disney comics. I just thought, well, this is, you know, for babies. But after I read through the stack, I ended up pulling it out. And sometimes, you know, it'd be three different artists in one book. Some of the stories were okay, but then this one, his stories, I just couldn't stop reading. And even though they all had that Disney house style, you could tell, I could always tell his drawing style. I always called him the guy that draws really well. And he never stopped. He always had a clear line style, and I was showing this to Al one time. We were going through a quarter box, and he was asking who Carl Barks was. And I'd point out certain ones, but for some odd reason, I always thought his style had like a dusty quality to it. Like, you know, it was old lines and stuff.
Hmm.
But it didn't. It was smooth, but for some reason he always had a rustic, dusty look to it. But his artwork, stories, they just always molded. I always grew up reading, you know, Jack Kirby stories where people went underwater, went to outer space, went to other dimensions, you know. And I was always surprised when the Donald Duck and Uncle Scrooge stories, Karl Barks made you realize just how vast the world is. I read in an interview what he did was he subscribed to National Geographic. And wherever National Geographic was at the time, that's where he based his story on.
That's cool.
And I mean, you know, he went to silver mines. He went to Amazon jungles. He went, you know, to the Alps. He did go underwater. You know, I remember he went underground. One of my favorite stories is he went underground and met the Terries and the Fermis, people that caused earthquakes. And he always had, you know, creatures he imagined. It never stopped. I always loved Karl Barks. I love his stories. I always found him an interesting person. He always made, you know, statements in his comics, even though these things were drawn for kids in 8 and 9 years old. As I said, you know, a long time ago, I found out when I was high school who he was and what his name was, but his work was never signed by it. But nevertheless, I could always tell his work, and I just never get tired of it.
Nice. Okay. So that was number three?
Yeah, nothing to add. Okay.
Oh, no. I really don't.
No, what I want to add is, like, here's a Walt Disney's comics and stories. Is that Karl Barks on the cover?
Yeah, you can tell. Come on.
We want to know.
It might be.
He's got that clean. He does have
nice,
a clean line work, though.
He does have a clean line work.
I want to say it is.
He goes with the top 80% of your artists so far.
You go ahead and open the book. It's all right. It's tapes off.
The covers always throw me because different people drew the covers. Walt Kelly of Pogo fame drew some of the covers.
No kidding.
But yeah, this front story is absolutely Karl Barks.
That's awesome. I thought we were going this is a game of, this has been stumped on more.
Yeah.
Well, Karl Barks, besides Donald Duck,
I wanna see.
He created
the Beagle Boys, right?
Yeah, he created the Beagle Boys, he created Uncle Scrooge.
Oh, he created Uncle Scrooge,
yeah,
that's cool.
Uncle Scrooge.
I know
Did
he popularized
Huey, Dewey, and Louie?
No, they were already in the cartoon.
Yeah, they were lame anyway.
The spell. You know,
Magic and Dispel.
Yeah.
See, it's funny. I know these characters. I know the characters from DuckTales because I grew up, in the 80s.
That whole book is in
cartoons.
Barks, though, is it?
No, I love this guy, but I don't know who it is. It's not Karl Barks.
Okay.
But the other ones are not.
So at that time, they weren't. They didn't give credit to the artists and the writers?
No.
Oh, man, DC didn't even do that. There was, like, in the 60s, a lot of times they wouldn't give you credit, so you didn't know who it was.
That sucks.
It would just say Bob Kane, and then it wasn't even Bob Kane.
It was
Sheldon Moldoff.
Well, some artists did.
Bill
like
Finger?
I know Bob, what was it, Bob Bowling and Bob Montana of Archie. They used to sign their work.
Yes, some people did, yes.
There was a few, and there was a few... with DC and some of the earlier companies, but the one that started issuing credits is Stan Lee. Stan Lee was the one that said, people, we should put this in there. I've always heard that about the Jack Kirby and Stan Lee thing, about Jack Kirby never understood, but Stan Lee always had his eye on the prize.
Don giving Stan Lee credit.
Well,
yeah.
I know. But
jeez.
I mean, that's
he does that occasionally.
I know.
That's the thing about Stan Lee that I do like. It was how he put things together. I'll give him props for all these things. But it was Stan Lee was the one that came up with that and started issuing. And then after Marvel was doing it for a while, DC eventually did. But there were some artists with DC that used to sign their work, just like with Archie and a few of the others. But I don't think any of the Disney artists could.
I seem to remember this guy, Ruben Moreira from the 50s, who used to sign his work. So you always knew who he was because, I like his work. But, there wasn't that many, though.
Well,
Toth might have occasionally. I think I remember seeing his name on some stuff.
Yeah, this book here has one Karl Barks story, and that's the front one.
But it's still nice, but
I
think the cover's Barks. It just looks too nice.
It could be. Like I said, his covers is the one thing. The finish was different on the covers and how they put them together.
I gotcha.
But, like I said, I assumed he did all of them.
This is a big book, too. I mean, wider
pages,
than...
pages, yeah.
And, like, dimension-wise, it seems like it's wider, right?
Yeah
it's a golden age. Silver age.
Yeah, when did they start making them smaller? It was in the...
60s.
It was in the 60s.
This is good radio right here. I bet you guys out there listening to us really want to see
this
book right
now. We'll put some
pictures
from it so you can see what we're looking at.
Yeah, I forgot. We're multimedia, baby.
We're multimedia.
Yeah.
Pretty soon there'll be a movie, too.
Yeah,
so
we're going to be interactive pretty soon.
Yeah. thought.
The 3D. Oh, I'll put it in the back.
Pretty soon there'll be two-dimension the movie.
We're gonna two-dimension in three dimensions.
We're going to go on adventures. And,
we're gonna scour the world for gold with
Uncle
Scrooge.
We're going to scour the world, yeah. We'll be coming to a town near you, so be on the lookout for us.
That is an awesome idea. I love it.
We've got the two-dimension mobile just ready to roll.
Jinkies! So what do we got, Don? What's number two?
All right, well, speaking of awesome, number two is...
Speaking of awesome.
The king of comics, Jack Kirby.
Well, you're actually throwing me off right now because I could have sworn he would have been number one, so...
Well,
no, I know who's going to be number one.
All right, let me think about that one.
No, Jack. I know. It starts with an M. I bet you.
Well, Jack Kirby was the other one that I could tell his work right off. He always had a bold, distinctive style. And as a younger kid, when I'd seen his Marvel comics, I had a Fantastic Four when I was a kid. And I always noticed the Marvel House style they had. Everybody had the square jaw and the boldness. But it's when he went to D.C. and was doing the new Jimmy Olsen and the other Fourth World titles he did, that's when I started recognizing him. Half the time I kept thinking, oh, this is kind of crude, you know, but at the same time I loved it. And everything was bursting off the page. I remember one issue of Jimmy Olsen, you know, you opened it up and it had that two-page spread, and it was all these people on these super motorbikes. They had the big tires and the big engines, and it's like 50 people just crashing across one side of the page to the other. There was demons and monsters, and he just never stopped. He just always put things together. When I was in high school, you know, by this time, he would do series for a while, and they canceled it. At the time, I didn't know they were canceling it. I just thought he got tired of it and wanted to come up with something else. And a lot of us, the circle of friends, you know, we're always drawing and making up our own characters and our own stories. And, you know, we'd do that. We'd never finish anything. You know, you'd be interested in doing something and you'd lose interest and start changing it, drawing something else. And I just assume that's what Jack Kirby was doing. He'd do 8 issues of OMAC and then he'd switch and do, you know, Commandy or something else.
You thought that, but Jack Kirby's not like us. He's something more.
Well,
he's superhuman.
Oh, he's. I don't see. You know, Al's got this old book on some of the old stuff he did for DC Comics. You know, some of the short stories that I guess was probably in Strange Tales.
Yeah, the
Strange
omnibus
Adventures.
Sample.
Was it the DC? Was that the Fourth World stuff?
No, it was before. He worked for DC with Joe Simon earlier. That's when he created Sandman and the Challenges of the Unknown.
Oh yeah.
And a few others. You know, he worked for several comic companies.
At the same time, probably.
Yeah. Well, I know he worked for another American or something.
Did this guy sleep?
No.
I don't see how he did it. He was very prolific. He put out a lot of work, and it was always good work. But even this early work, I guess it was the 50s, it is a simpler work, but it's still dynamic. And even, you know, it's a thing. One time I was reading an interview with the Hernandez brothers, and they were, you know, talk about influence and stuff. And they said one thing they learned was, I forgot how you say it now. But basically what they're saying, oh, restraint. And they said, well, actually, they started laughing. I says, the person we learned the most restraint from was Jack Kirby. Which, you know, when you think of Jack Kirby, you think of...
He's the king of loud.
Yeah, well, you think of all the people bursting forth on the page, like the motorcycle thing I was talking about. People jumping across the page with their legs spread, you know, power. The Kirby crackle everybody talks about. But the example they was given was when it was an issue of the Adventures, and Captain America said, I've got to go pick up our new members. And then it showed him at the airport, and he goes and picks up the Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver. But he's wearing a suit, you know, a plain clothes suit, and, you know, Wanda and Pedro are standing there dressed in a suit and a nice dress at the airport. And it's just a few panels, but he goes and introduces himself. I'm Steve Rogers, you know, I'm supposed to take you over there. And I thought, you know, you're right. Jack Kirby, he could draw restraint. Even though you think of him with the power, nobody could do it like him. But he never stopped. One question I've had my entire life was, what if he didn't leave Marvel and he stayed on the Fantastic Four his entire career? What would have happened? you know, everything was changing all the time.
We'd have about 10 times the amount of Fantastic Four characters, I could tell
well,
you.
Well, that's what one of my friends said. He goes, oh, we'd have, Marvel would have 10,000 more. But, you know, he never stopped. All the way to the very end, he never stopped. You can always, you know, whatever you see he did, it's just bursting forth. Some series he did, I in the late 70s, I never stopped buying his comics. They were always some of the first stuff I pulled off. But, you know, Devil Dinosaur, when I was getting them, I always enjoyed them, but I thought, well, this isn't his best work. When he was doing the Captain America stories for Marvel, when he returned, he also had a Black Panther miniseries. I always loved the Black Panther, but I found I wasn't really enjoying that series as much. I bought every one, but I just thought, well, this isn't as good. Reading them now, they're just great fun. You know, I mean, even if it's a pale comparison of his early work, it's still far beyond anybody else. There was nobody like him. He single-handedly, you know, even though he didn't create the superhero, he showed everybody else how to do it. He single-handedly completely changed the entire comics medium.
Well, I agree, and, you know, I'll say something. That's actually a good and a bad thing, because there was a lot of artists who were some of my favorite artists who went from drawing, like, you know, more of a realistic style. And Kirby was so great at doing the superheroes that he put everybody paled in comparison.
Yeah.
I mean, people like Bob Powell and even like Bill Everett and all these beautiful artists who were doing, when Kirby got in his prime in Marvel, there was nobody that could touch him. So it was kind of like, you know, as a kid, I had the same thing with you with Barks was the same thing with me and Kirby. It was like, wow, that's a Kirby book. I could tell Wally Wood, I could tell these other guys, but it was just like the Kirby book had some kind of energy coming out of it that just hit you. And, you know, it kind of spoiled us in a way, because everybody expected superhero books to be this Kirby-esque thing. And a lot of guys were like, you know, pale in comparison, who were very, very good artists, but definitely Kirby is the ultimate comic book artist.
That's the mark of a great artist, to stand head and shoulders above everyone else and to be able to be recognized in that industry.
The ultimate.
You know, it's something. Another one I would say is Frank Frazetta. The reason
yes.
I say this, I heard, I saw Gary Groth at a panel in Dallas, Texas, and he was complaining about, he was at the Marvel office, and there were some people showing work, and this one guy had paintings of Conan. And he said he had a really neat geometric style. And Marie Severin was looking at him, and she said, well, this is nice, but you need to paint more like Frazetta. And, you know, the guy laughed, and he was kind of upset, because I don't want to paint like Frank Frazetta. I want to paint like me. Well, you know, somebody brought that up, that they were in the office, too, and what she meant was, you know, they're looking for the dynamism and everything that Frank Frazetta put, some of the sensibilities. Because that's what we were wanting. You know, that's what we bought. But yeah, after Jack Kirby popped up and everybody saw what he's doing, it did change. And there were some other fantastic artists that I love their work as well. And you're right, it did change it. But you still had other artists with, you know, their own sensibilities.
Yeah, exactly right. But to me, like you said, good example is Frazetta. Frazetta and Kirby were like from another world.
Absolutely.
The work was so dynamic and they were so strong in their style that it was just, you know, everything else paled in comparison.
Yeah, and then you had so many people trying to draw like them, and it wasn't the same.
Some people transcended them, like people like Jeff Jones, who started out kind of trying to be like Frazetta, and a few others kind of went in their own directions and became masters in their own field.
Right.
But, you know, when you look at Boris Vallejo, what a great artist and a technician he is.
Yeah.
Frazetta's, to me anyway, is always going to be like, you know, head and tail over him, because while Frazetta gave you something that was like beyond the painting, it was almost like, you know, grabbing at you. With Boris, a lot of times you just look at the beautiful technique and the
right.
wonderful.
I agree drawing. With you right there. Frazetta had more style, I would say.
Yeah.
He had the same technique that Boris did, but he had more creativity, more style. you know?
Yeah, we
Boris was more
at,
by the numbers.
Yeah, with Boris, you were just the artifice of it is like, you know, wow, look at that beautiful painting or whatever. For Zed, it was like, damn, this monster. I mean, when I was a kid, Creepy issue number 6, the cover scared me. It was like a gargoyle, like right up on this guy. Just looking at the cover scared me. And then the same thing with Kirby. It was like, you look at the Fantastic Four 57 with the big Dr. Doom head and all the characters around him, and you're like,
oh, classic.
This is grabbing you, and you're like, yeah, okay, this is it. Almost like the Beatles, too, you know, back in the day. So.
But that stuff, and Kirby, like you were saying earlier, Don, about another artist, like Kirby was one that you wanted to sit down and just start drawing. He inspired you.
And still, whenever I get one of his books, it makes me want to draw.
But I know my generation, you were even saying earlier, I know growing up and, you know, a lot of friends my age, I'm sure Rook also, when we saw Kirby's work, by the time we were exposed to it, you know, it was already 20 years old or more. So yeah, we thought it was crude. We were like, you know, what is this? This is
Their
from
fans.
Another age. Yeah. But obviously over time you grow to appreciate art a little more. And yeah, I love Kirby. I know Rook loves Kirby. Everyone in my generation loves him and respects him. I mean,
yeah.
You can't help but do it.
I remember when he came back to Marvel, people were like, oh God, Kirby, haven't we gone past this now? You know, blah, 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 blah. But then as the years go on, like you said, you grow to appreciate it because you can see it more. It was like, it might not have been like John Byrne, let's say, because it was a different kind of style, but the energy was unbelievable that was coming off those pages.
Well, there was nobody like him. But like I said, when he came back to Marvel, to me that wasn't his best work, but it was still something. And there was, he did the 2001 Space Odyssey. You know, they did that oversized, tabloid-sized adaptation. And when you read the comic, it's like watching a movie. And then they continued on and did a series, and I kept thinking, really, they're going to do a series? And it always started the same thing. You know, it was always usually Spaceman, and he'd end up meeting the alien, you know, some alien in front of the monolith. And I thought, okay. And I kept buying them. But every once in a while, there'd be a gem. He did 2 issues about, in 2001, about a guy called Marok. You know, he was a barbarian. And it just kept going and going. He ended up, you know, they were basically Huns, raiders. They were coming in and raiding peaceful villages. And they invaded one village, and there was this old man, and he was beating the living hell out of them with some kind of a rod. It was a metal bat. And they'd never seen anything like it. They were always fighting with bones and, you know, leather. And so Marok, instead of killing the guy, he said, I need to know, where did you get this? And the old man looks at him, and he takes him over, and there's the monolith out in the swamp. And the monolith talked to Marok as well. So he said, the stone talked to me. So they both kind of became a team. And everything changed after that. You know, whenever they'd raid another village, they'd take all the able-bodied men and put them in the army. You know, and his men were getting upset about it. But he started amassing a great army. They were eating horses. And the men were getting upset.
Ew.
The men were getting upset. Says, what is this? He's wanting us to ride them. You know, and they were trying to teach the horses how to ride them. I said, eat them, I say. But it was stuff like this going on and on. And the old man was showing them how to, he kept seeing visions of this woman called, I think, Jessica. And he was going to go find her. But he amassed this great army. And the old man was showing him these big stone jars he came up with. He can keep water and food fresh. And Mara got upset and said, how are we going to carry this stuff? And he was starting to beat the old man. I says, think. This is going to break people's backs. How are you going to carry it? Think faster, old man. Oh, well, this has happened. It was 3 panels. He knocked one of the jars over. The old man's laying there on the ground and Marok's pounding him. And it shows the old man's eyes looking. And in 3 panels, it shows the lid of the jar rolling. And the old man is looking at it. And, you know, you can see in those three panels at the very, there were 3 last panels. And you know what the old man came up with, looking at it. And then it said, next issue, Wheels of Fire. You know, and then the next issue was a continuation of Marok, and these men had all these big carts and horses, and they went through. Still one of my very favorite Jack Kirby stories.
Yeah.
You know, and then eventually it turned into the Spaceman thing again.
Yeah.
And at the end of 2001, I guess it's about 11, 12 issues, Machine Man was introduced, which was another one of my favorite pieces he did. The whole thing starts out with these robots people were building, and they're supposed to think like a human being, but they're all freaking out. Who am I? Who am I? And they have to destroy them. And they finally just decided the whole project is, you know, gone, so they destroyed all the robots. They had a explosive implanted inside their head. Well, they switched about. There's one more robot left, and one of the professors took it home and said, yeah, it's a strange experiment. He was raising the robot as his own son. And then it switches back to him, and the old man, basically, he gave the robot a face, you know, treated him as a son, and there was no identity crisis. And then the robot is reaching his head, or the professor, and he takes out the explosive device, and he says, you got to go. And, you know, he goes on, that was the beginning of Machine Man. Just absolute genius. That was one issue. You know, Jack Kirby could write. You know, I mean, not always. Some of his stories were dorky, and sometimes he could end up, you know. I didn't like how some of his characters talked. They always had that street, tough New York style, you know. But
well, that's the thing. That's another thing. That, glad you mentioned that about Kirby and Frazetta. Both of them were sweet, wonderful guys in real life, but when they were young, they were tough Brooklyn guys that fought all the time, and they were badasses. You didn't mess with them. And I think that mentality and that kind of energy came across in their work. They were such natural artists that it just came across naturally, because you can tell by both, you know, the characters that Kirby draws and Frazetta, you don't want to mess with those barbarians and those Kirby guys that, like, you know, with the punches and all the action. You don't want to mess with those guys. And it really, I think for me, it comes off on paper better than almost anybody else.
It's like Kirby had so many of his books published. He's like, well, you don't like this book? I'm going to fuck you up.
No,
they made him.
He was a sweet guy, but I think when he was a kid living in Brooklyn, it was like fights all the time when you were a kid. Same with Frazetta, I think.
And then Will Eisner. You met the writer for that Will Eisner Spirited Life book in Tampa.
Yeah, at that convention we went to.
Bob Andelman. But in that book, Jack Kirby worked for Will Eisner at Eisner Iger Studios. And Will Eisner was talking a story. Jack Kirby was 17 years old. And in the building, they had a towel service. You know, this is back in the 40s or 30s. But they had a towel service. You know, you paid for people to bring in clean towels. And each day they come in, or each week they come and take them back. And I guess it was mob run. And there was some kind of a problem with it. And they were charging more money, or you had to use the service. And Will Eisner found a cheaper service. And these guys came in, and they were really riding them. I was just like the way they described it was like any old movie where the mob comes in, listen, pal, you don't like this, you're going to be talking to us. And Will Eisner didn't know what to do with it. And all of a sudden, Jack Kirby, 17-year-old Jack Kirby, you know, was sitting at his drafting table working. And, you know, when this is going on, he just puts his pen down, gets off the desk, comes over and walks up, gets right in the guy's face and says, listen, there's not any problem with this. You guys come back over here, you're going to deal with me. Take it back to your boss. That was the end of it. And, you know, Will Eisner's telling that story, laughing about it. You know, but, I mean, Jack Kirby was a small man, but he didn't seem like it. He seemed like he was 10 feet tall. It doesn't matter your physical stature, it's your spirit.
That's right. That's why I'm like 10 feet tall.
I've always seen you as a giant, Dallas.
We don't mess with you.
But, you know, Jack Kirby, like I said, what Al said, I've always heard. My friend Britt met him a couple of times. And, you know, like I said, Jack Kirby could have been the biggest jerk in the whole planet, and Britt would have loved him just as much because of his work. But he wasn't. Britt just talks like he was the greatest. He sent him a Christmas card. He invited him over his house with his friends to swim. But Jack Kirby never walked around with a chip on his shoulder. I've never heard any stories. But it was funny when I read that. Will Eisner said it was because of that 17-year-old kid I had. Mark Evanier put out a book called Kirby. I think Al has a copy. I have a copy.
Behind you somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to say I'll probably turn around and see it in a second.
It's right there.
But it's
all dusty, though, probably.
Mark Evanier was an assistant to Jack Kirby. I know, which is funny because he's a writer. And Mark Evanier always made jokes about it that I don't know why he hired me. There was another young man that they just kind of hung out. So I think part of it is he's lonely and he wanted people around him. But Mark Evanier also worked on the side for this other guy that put out, I think, those black light posters of the Kirby
stuff. Yeah, I remember.
Stuff. In the 70s, black light posters were popular. And a lot of the Kirby Marvel stuff they put out as big black light posters. You used to see them in all the discount stores and stuff. This is in the early 70s. Well, this company was going bankrupt. And I don't know exactly what the deal was. Mark Evanier explained it. But basically, the guy that ran the company was in great trouble, and he was blaming it on Mark Evanier. And he was calling and giving Mark Evanier threatening phone calls, saying, you know, I'm going to take you down, this is your fault, you know, I'm going to tell the judges and that, and your dad's going to, you know, really suffer for this financially. You know, Mark Evanier was a young man. He was scared to death. Well, he went into work, you know, Jack Kirby was sitting there drawing. Mark Evanier wasn't going to bother him with it. And then Jack Kirby kind of looked at him, you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. And then he called at other insistence, says, listen, I need you to go out and get this for me. You know, go to the store and pick this up for me. And as the guy was doing it, Mark Evanier went to get his jacket. He was going with him because, you know, there's no reason to be there. And then Jack Kirby says, no, Mark, I need you here. He can take care of that. And they both looked at each other like, okay. So the guy left. When the guy left, Jack Kirby stopped working and looked at him. I said, all right, what's going on? And Mark Evanier said, I promised myself I wouldn't bother him. I wouldn't bother him with my personal problems. And that lasted for 2 seconds. And he just opened up and started crying, told the whole story, you know, broke down. Jack Kirby said, what's this guy's number? He walks over the phone and calls him and says, I know what you've been doing. I know what you're going through. Leave this boy alone. This is it. Don't bother him again. And that was the end of it. And Mark Evanier said, I never told anybody the story before. He said, but now I know why he was so good at drawing superheroes. He was one. Absolutely. Jack Kirby, you are the man. You are the man.
You know, I love hearing these stories about him and other people in our industry, because it's nice to hear these people that have a big heart, you know. We need more people like that.
Well, like I said, it was his artwork was what got me, and his storytelling. He was just, nobody else was like him. And you're number two, but you're right up there at the top.
Well, speaking of number one, drum roll.
This is an artist that I didn't particularly care for. I've said this in another issue, or another episode. I'm not talking about so long, but it's the French artist Moebius. Moebius, as Dallas says properly.
Moebius.
Moebius.
In the very beginning, I did like his artwork and thought he was good, but it just wasn't a style that appealed to me until I saw the Inkle. And as I said before, the Inkle was everything I ever would have wanted to do if I was ever able to, you know, do cartoons for a living. Everything he puts in, it just seemed like that's all he's ever worked on. It's always thick and robust, and he's very prolific. He just puts things, one thing out after another. The Adina series he did with Stella and Aiden, it just kept building and never stopped. The Airtight Garage. I used to see these serialized in heavy metal, and again, they always caught me. I thought, well, these are pretty neat. But they never made sense. I mean, it'd be 2, 3, 4 pages. It always varied, and it always ended in some kind of cliffhanger, and the next issue, or the next few pages, it's like, where's he going with this? It always seemed like a mishmash. I'd always hear people go, oh, what genius their Tiger Garage is. Well, when Epic in the mid-80s started putting these out, they put it out in one collected volume, and I remember reading this thing, you know, thinking, well, this is okay, but it's just, where's he going with this? And all of a sudden, the last page, everything tied in. And I like things when they end. When you read American comics, it's rare if you ever have an ending on anything. It just continues on and on and on. And a lot of times I find when series do end, sometimes it's kind of a letdown. It's not as good as what you thought it would be. It starts out on fire and then kind of dwindles to nothing, and nobody really seems to care. And when I finished that last page, I thought, well, there you go. All of a sudden, it went from this work where I'm not really sure where it is to one of the greatest pieces I ever read in my life. And unfortunately, you don't see too much of his work anymore here in the United States. But when I do see it, I just think, I don't know how he can come up with this. Sometimes I bring in some of his books on his different work, and people say, that's not all one artist. I don't understand how somebody can go from one style to another style and have a command on every one of them. But he does.
So. But he does. He's the man. I agree. He's good. And he is good at wrapping up stories. And I totally agree with you on the Airtight Garage. I love that ending. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It fits.
It did just build a whole scope for everything.
He is one hell of a storyteller. And again, he's a fairly clean artist.
Yeah.
Pretty, you know, economy of line. Real tight.
Well, in the very beginning, he did he used to use a lot of detail, even in some of the early Mobius. I think the first Mobius story he did was The Detour, and a lot of detail. But he was basically talking about how he was using detail to cover up weak drawings. You know, if there was any kind of problem with the composition or anything, he would just add more detail and cover it up. So he started trying to strip things down. I know a lot of people get upset because some people really love detail. And they get upset when artists start stripping everything down to almost nothing. Well, sometimes I agree with it. I do like some detail at times. It depends. But when Mobius did it, it was just phenomenal.
What's his real name?
Jean Girard. Okay. I don't know exactly if I'm pronouncing it correctly. He was, of all things, a Western artist. In Europe, Western comic strips are hugely popular. And he had a strip called Blueberry, Lieutenant Blueberry. And it was about a cavalry officer in the United States, you know, Army. And I was always amazed. He was popular for it. A lot of his friends were doing, I think it was a magazine called Pilot. I don't know how they'd say it.
Pilot, I think.
Oh, Pilot. Oh, really?
I think.
Well, that would make sense. But they were starting to do a lot of science fiction, really experimental science fiction stories. And they were wanting him to do one, and he wanted to, but he was afraid he'd alienate his audience because they were used to seeing him as Jean Girard. See, he used a pen named Mobius, and he did a strip called The Detour, which was amazing. The artwork was amazing. The story was actually really well written and unique. And, you know, it was a success, so he started doing other stories. They were always short stories, you know, 2, 3, 4 pages. And, in a few years, Mobius was far more famous than Jean Girard. And that's when, what do they call it, the humanoids are so low?
Les humanoids associés?
Yeah, I think
something
so.
Something along those lines.
But they created Metal Hurling. And in the United States, they started bringing some of these stories over in heavy metal. But that's when it went on. Those Western stories that I always see in magazines, they always look pretty nice. And when Epic did all the Mobius series, they did the Blueberry as well.
You know those Mobius series, like the books that you have?
Yes.
I was looking for some on Amazon. Those things are like 70, 80 bucks each.
Yeah, well, they're out of print.
Yeah, really?
So I was like, you know, Don, let me borrow all of them.
Those
Epic sequential orders.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, I might want to pick up a couple. I figured 10, 20 bucks maybe. But the ones I could find were like 80 bucks. I was surprised.
Wow.
Yeah, I didn't realize they're out of print, though.
That's one thing. When he did the, when they started publishing his Western work, it was Blueberry. And I bought the first one. And honestly, I thought it was good, but I just wasn't interested in cowboys. And I thought, well, this is all right. But, you know, we were a young couple. I was trying to be careful with my money. And I said I wasn't going to buy any more. Well, I was reading some magazine, and they were going over the Mobius stuff, and they had covers to some of the later Blueberry stories. And I thought, oh, man, that looks nice. I wish I would have bought those. Of all things, I was in Oklahoma visiting, and I went to a comic store, and they had a fire sale. I guess there was a fire that broke out in the store, and there was smoke damage. And I got all those Blueberry graphic novels, I think, for 30%. I remember when I took them off. They were fine. The only thing that bothered was the end pages. When the books closed, the outside were a little smoky. I don't care. But the covers and everything inside was fine. And I remember when I brought them up to the counter, the guy behind the counter said, he looked at two of them and said, you know, this is a little bit more damage. I'm going to give you, you know, another 10%. So I got the books at a fraction of the cost. Absolutely loved them. after that, they ended up, I guess there was 5 books, and then they ended up doing 3 more, you know, and then a couple more. It finished out the entire Mobius Blueberry run. I got every one of them, but the last one I saw in Berkeley, California when I was on vacation. And I thought, well, I'll pick that up when I go back home. I bought so many things here. Never saw the book again. And then when I went back to California years later, you know, of course, you can't find it. It really upset me. The books went out of print. You know, Mobius went back to France and disappeared, and, you know, he couldn't find them. I ended up, I'd always look for them on eBay, and I found the one I was looking for on eBay, and the guy was selling it. I think it was $6. And, you know, this is when the economy was starting to take a turn for the worse, and he said, he was a guy in Los Angeles, and he said he was selling all his collection out of his garage, not because he didn't want it, but he couldn't afford it. He was out of work. And like I said, I got it for $6, including shipping. I'm sorry, man, but thank you.
All right, I found Blueberry for $30 on Amazon, but some of this Airtight Garage is $60.
Yeah.
Arzak, $148.
For a paperback? Was it a hardcover?
Paperback.
Yeah, the paperback.
And then, well, what's this? The Inkle. The Inkle Classic Collection hardcover. $349?
Well, that's the one I showed to you, but that's the big one. It must be the slipcase.
$350.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Graffiti Editions put out all those epic books. This is in 1990 or 91. They were taking all the epic books and they were putting them together in these fantastic hardbacks. And my friend and I saw them, because, you know, we already had all the epic stuff, but they had the Inkle in one hardback, which would be beautiful. And they were the regular French album size. But we were doing the math. If you would have bought all the epic books, the Graffiti thing would have cost about $1 less. But they were really nice packages, and they were on hardbacks. But they did all that, all the Blueberry stuff, the Airtight Garage, you know, some of the other stories. I wish I had gotten those. I imagine those would be a really pretty penny. But to me, the Mobius stuff, that should be in print. You know, whenever you go into, you know, Borders is gone, but Barnes & Noble or any of these places have a graphic novel section, I'm glad they have them. But they're a mess. I mean, they're haphazard. They're not thought. It's just piles of stuff in there.
Yep.
And you know the thing is,
it's all American comics too, mostly.
Oh yeah,
and manga.
Well, the manga section is actually kind of nice. You know, everything is mostly one size, and you know it looks nice.
But there's just no market for European comic books.
Well, it is, but you know,
in a big bookstore like that.
I agree, but I think some people would enjoy those Tintin, or Tintin, as I'm told.
Well, they're releasing a live action movie.
Yes,
Tintin.
Spielberg.
Yeah, so hopefully that'll drum up some interest over here in America.
Well, you can get those books. They shrunk them down and had collections, but I see them in stores. Asterix is another one. It has a mass appeal. But, you know, sometimes I always wondered if they should take some of these graphic novels or trade paperbacks and put them in other sections. You know, like the Cartoon History of the Universe should be in the history section. I guess they wouldn't, because people are looking for prose books. But just because they're illustrated comics, it doesn't mean they have to be in that one section.
Oh, I agree with you. I think Al and I do.
Stuff,
yep.
The Mobius stuff, it should stay in print and be available for everybody.
I had no clue that stuff was out of print. I'll have to dig those out.
But those, of my favorite reproductions of any of these was the Epic, you know, an Epic
those
comics.
Those are good, yeah.
And because they, you know, Mobius added notes to everything. He introduced each story and talked about it and basically told about his feelings and why he did these stories. That's genius. And when Humanoids put out that fantastic Inkle collection, I really missed reading those notes. You know, they're not in there. But, I mean, I'm happy it's out. I don't even know if that's available anymore. They were selling all over the place. Well, like I said, in the United States, nobody can get Mobius in English anymore. But if I took over the world, Mobius would be out all the time.
There'd be Mobius all over the place.
And this has been an episode of If Don Took Over the World.
If Don Took Over the World. There'd be death penalty for parking violations, and Latin women would not be allowed to have blonde hair.
Oh, here we go again about this. Well,
okay.
I think that's a very strong top 10 you've got.
Yeah.
And I think this is a good stopping point. I think it's getting a little late. I I'm thinking maybe we should save the "What are you reading" till next episode, and we can have a big extravaganza in episode 15. I want to thank everyone for listening, though, and hopefully you're entertained and you enjoy Don's top 10 artist list. You can find us at twodimensionpodcast.blogspot.com, where you can download all of our episodes. We also always have images of whatever we're talking about on each episode and links to different sites, and you can leave a comment there, and we promise that we'll get back to you if you leave a comment. We love comments. You can also find us on Facebook. Just look up Two Dimension Podcast. Friend us, like us, leave some comments there also. We're always trolling around Facebook as well. Thanks again, everyone. And until next time, take care of yourselves and read more comics.